So it's a pleasure to introduce myself. I've been here for 33 years, and I'm still here. So is post-transition fertility too low, population aging, and transfer systems? This topic is of sort of prominent concern. Population aging is occurring most places around the world, and where it isn't occurring now, it's going to be occurring soon. And all countries have some sorts of systems for reallocating resources from working age people to children and to the elderly. And population aging puts severe pressures on such systems in many countries, particularly in rich industrial countries, as we'll be seeing. Now, population aging, as I look at it, is mainly due to low fertility, although it's also partly due to longer life. And in the U.S., we're about to have a period of very rapid population aging over the next 25 years or so, as the baby boom generation moves into old age. But population aging in the U.S. isn't due to the baby boom, it's due to the baby bust, it's due to the rapid decline in fertility in the 1960s and 1970s, and the relatively low fertility in historical context that we've had since then. And so if population aging in the U.S. is due to the baby bust, at least in part, does that mean that we would be better off with higher fertility? That's the kind of question I will be talking about. And, of course, the U.S. is sort of towards the high end of fertility for rich industrial countries. Europe is much lower. At this point, well, Taiwan has a total fertility rate of 0.9. 42% of the world population is living in countries with below replacement fertility, according to the United Nations. And that number, I think, is continuing to grow, that proportion. And so the question here is whether fertility has fallen too low in some sense in these countries and whether we might be better off if it was a little bit higher. Of the many countries in the world that responded to a United Nations survey on their views on population, 56 countries viewed their fertility as too high. Not so surprising, but there are 51 countries that view their fertility as too low. And many of these 51 countries have explicit population policies in place to try to raise fertility. So that's the setting for this question. Now I'm going to be drawing, this paper is joint with Andy Mason, and together we direct the National Transfer Accounts Project, which I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. But that project, among other things, estimates age profiles of labor income and of consumption, and it also estimates private sort of familial transfers to children and the elderly, and it estimates public transfers. And so we'll be drawing on those data in this investigation. I want to mention the important limitation that we will be taking the currently existing systems of transfers of support for dependent ages. These currently existing systems we will be taking as given and held fixed into the future. Now, the reality is that these systems are going to be changing. Certainly in poor third world countries, many of these countries will be moving towards something more like a European welfare state. as Latin America has already done, while they're still quite poor, and as Japan did as it transitioned from a poor third world country to a leading rich industrial country. They also adopted pretty much wholesale the machinery of a European welfare state. So there are going to be big changes in the developing world, but there are also going to be big changes, I expect, in the rich industrial countries. I'm sure we're going to be working longer and retiring later. I'm sure pension benefits are going to be cut in one way or another. And on the healthcare side, it's harder to say since there's so much momentum towards raising expenditures per person covered by these public health care programs. But I'm sure that there will be reductions, at least relative to that long-term trend in the future. So what I'm going to be doing, what Andy and I have done, is limited in this way. But at the same time, the fact that we're drawing on a wide range of different countries and different kinds of support systems, as we'll see in a moment, gives it a little more generality, perhaps, and we may be able to get some clues to what's likely to happen in the future as these systems change. I think the last thing I'll say before we get going is that it's very tempting to slip into calling this a study of optimal fertility. It's really not, although I may occasionally use those words. If we were seriously trying to ask what an optimal level of fertility would be, we'd have to start with what fertility people want and what their changes in satisfaction and happiness and so on would be with a slightly higher or slightly lower fertility. But we're abstracting completely from that. We're just looking at the way that fertility leads to population age distributions and they interact with the support systems. And the other thing we're not looking at is the eventual effects of variations in fertility levels on future population sizes, which will have environmental impacts and political and military and cultural impacts and so on. We're not looking at that either. So this is a limited study, but we are going to, if we have time, come in the end to taking into account the fact that there's capital in these economies and that higher fertility leads to more rapidly reforced growth and requires then higher savings rates and more investment in order to maintain a given level of capital for workers. Okay, so let's start by, I'll say a word about this National Transfer Accounts project. It is a collection of new methods we use to estimate economic relations among ages and generations, economic flows. It's done in a way that is consistent with standard national accounts as developed by the United Nations in SNA, their system of national accounts. But it extends these by including public and private transfers and by breaking everything down by age. And it's an exhaustive decomposition of the things that are covered in standard national accounts. That doesn't mean it covers everything, because there are a lot of things that aren't covered in the standard accounts. And I should say, going forward, we're adding the dimension of time use, and currently these things are not by sex, they're by sort of an average, and we're looking at them by sex in the future as well. Yeah.
What about transfers through the market? I'm thinking of
saving, those are in there as well.
And then you,
Sometimes it's you, sometimes it's your employer-provided pension plan, some countries it might be a government pension plan that's funded. Those kinds of things are also included. So we have a book that just came out last fall. In truth, it has something like, I don't know, probably 75 or 80 authors, but Andy and I are we're sort of lead authors and editors.
Get out.
at all, yeah. And you can buy this book for $200, but you can also download it free on the web, courtesy of IDRC, a Canadian foundation, having bought up the electronic rights that they also support some of the research. So if you go to this web address, you should be able to find out how to download it, either as a PDF or as an ebook. Okay, and this is the geographic coverage, which isn't completely up to date, because now, wherever Turkey is, somewhere, I've lost.
Yeah. It's hard to tell from the Mediterranean.
I guess this is Turkey, yeah.
No, you
don't. No? No. Okay, get it. No, you're in.
Just north of Syria.
My problem is I can't tell where the water is there.
Okay. The water is.
And Egypt is going to be joining shortly, and there are other countries that will be coming on. These are the countries that are now. They're now 37. And this was our last meeting in Belo Horizonte in December. And if you look carefully, you would see a lot of people you know, like Miguel Sanchez Romero, and Carol is here somewhere. I identified her last night, and Andy and I, and Eduardo Neto from the old days, and Bernardo is here. There's Bernardo, I think, and Piedad is here somewhere. There she is. And and Tim is right behind. Is that Tim?
Yeah.
So there are lots of people that you know, and Yvonne is here. Okay, anyway. Okay, so the starting point is that we estimate cross-sectional aid profiles of labor income and consumption, and I'm going to be using those a lot in today in this talk. And they are population averages at each age. So they're averaged across males and females. When we're doing labor income, it's averaged across people who have zero labor income at a given age, and so on. It's an average. And then these age profiles, which are derived from existing data sets, after a lot of work. This is a huge amount of work for any given country. And each country has its own team, and it takes teams a lot of work. And So then the age profiles are adjusted to match the totals in national income accounts for given population age distributions. And then we standardize, we'll be doing this throughout, by dividing, for each country, we divide the age profiles by average labor income ages 30 to 49, post-school, before retirement is the idea. So consumption includes private expenditures within the household that are imputed to individuals, and public in-kind transfers like public education, publicly provided health care, long-term care, but not public pensions, because that's just money and you could give it away or save it or whatever. It's not consumption. For private expenditures within the household, we are able to look at health and education by age in one way or another, and then the rest of consumption, the other, is allocated to individuals in the household in proportion to assumed equivalent adult consumer weights, which are the same across all countries. 0.4 of an adult for ages 0 to 4, and then rising linearly to 1 at age 20. And then once we've done this calculation for each individual in each household, then we average across all individuals in the whole country, and similarly for labor income. And then by comparing labor income of someone in a household to the consumption we impute in this way, we can also infer what transfers are, public transfers and private transfers, public transfers we have direct information.
Excuse me, Ron.
Yeah.
Does it matter that, you know, some things can't be disaggregated, like defense spending, is a big chunk of GDP, but isn't consumed by
yeah.
large groups?
Yeah, well, we'll see in a moment that things that cannot be allocated are assumed to just be proportional per capita okay. across the whole age distribution. NIH funding, the United Nations diplomatic mission from the U.S., our local library, these kinds of things, police, fire, we can't allocate in there. Just a death parade. Okay, so this is what they look like. So there are 22 of the 37 or so that we now have. You can see there's a lot of variation in level of consumption. Remember, this is relative to labor income, age 30 to 49. A lot of variation in levels of consumption, quite a bit of variation in the age pattern of labor income. But so to try to extract some signal from this noise, let's look at the age profiles for the richest quartile and for the poorest quartile out of those countries. And here the poor countries are in blue and the rich countries are in red. And not as much difference in labor income at young ages as you might expect, and that's partly because Nigeria has very low labor income for young people. There's high youth unemployment, and they don't really get going until their 20s. We'll look at that in a moment. I don't recall Kenya, but it may be affecting it also. In any event, a higher youth labor income, but the big characteristic features here to look at in contrast are high human capital spending in the rich industrial countries relative to the poor countries, flat consumption in the poor countries relative to very strongly increasing in the rich countries.
Consumption includes healthcare?
That includes healthcare, long-term care. And we'll see a little more detail on that in a moment. And then you see in the rich countries, okay, they keep working or they have high labor income a bit longer, perhaps because their work is more cerebral, less brawn, but then, boom, they just stop working and have very low labor income at older ages compared to in the poor countries. So those are the main features of interest here. Now, I want to contrast a couple of countries for primarily labor income here. This is Austria and Nigeria. Now, you might think Nigeria would be the one who would have early labor income, but no. Austria stands out in the whole set of countries as having very early start and steep increase in labor income by age. That's reflecting a peculiarity of the Austrian system, which is a heavy reliance on apprenticeships rather than formal education. So you see this unusual pattern. They start very young. And there's a little bit of that in Germany and maybe some other places, not nearly as strong as in Austria. And then a very early departure from the labor force and quite complete departure. But they're not the first to depart. I think Slovenia has the earliest. I think this is Slovenia here. But Austria is one of the earlier ones. And then you compare that to Nigeria with a very late start and a very late finish. So the fact that the Nigerians are working later, their consumption is pretty flat with age, is going to mean that old age is relatively cheap in Nigeria, but childhood is relatively expensive. And so we might expect that a lower level of fertility is going to be maximizing support ratios in Nigeria than in Austria, and we'll see if that's the case. And then here is a look at consumption. So this is comparing Sweden and Spain. This one with the rapid increase at older ages is Sweden, and that's healthcare, long-term care, things like that. Spain, well, in fact, what happens in Spain is that their private consumption really dips in old age for whatever reason, and they also have pretty high and and fairly rapidly increasing health expenditures in old age, but you combine that with the falling private consumption and you get this sort of flat profile that looks like Nigeria or most of our poor country profiles. So again, old age is going to be a lot more expensive in Sweden than in Spain. Okay, now here is the U.S. Some of you have seen this before. This is the age profile of consumption in 1960, 1981, and 2007, just before the crisis. We can come up to 2009 or 2010, but I think it's more interesting to look pre-crisis. And here is the gray at the bottom is what Mike was asking about. That's public other. You can see it's not a big component of total consumption. And then I guess the things I point out here are the purple is human capital investment. That's public spending on education. This little blue here is private spending on education. And you see how the public spending on education has grown over time relative to labor income. But the big story here is how this brown layer, which is public spending on health care, which 1960 was before Medicare, before Medicaid, was very small. You see how it has expanded so dramatically by 1981 and expanded even further by 2007. You also see that that's not the whole story about rising role of expenditures for health. This is private expenditures, which used to be relatively small. And then you see how private expenditures have grown, particularly at older ages, and continuing in 2007. And here you have the sharp drop in private expenditure corresponding to age 65 when people become eligible for Medicare. Okay, in any event, you see the changing shape. This is even, in third world countries, you don't have this fall off in old age. I think that's because we had, even in 1960, we had relatively low co-residence of,
I was just wondering, is this controlling for differences in age composition between these
clients? This is per capita, okay. Yeah. So this is not weighted by the population age distribution. And I'm not going to show you any that are weighted, but of course that's very interesting also because in the industrial countries you have a huge weight in the relatively speaking, of the older ages in the third world countries, it's just a tiny sliver of resources being reallocated to the elder. Okay, and then this is the last I'm going to show you on these profiles. This is the U.S. in 2003. It looks a little different than in 2007. This is the Philippines. And if we look down here, we have the public transfers, we call them inflows. These are the public transfers received in the U.S. by age. This would be long-term care. And these are the public transfers made. Those would be tax payments. And so you see heavy net public transfers received by children and also public heavy net public transfers received by the elderly, whereas the prime working age ages are paying net taxes. You compare this to the Philippines, and you see, first of all, the scale is the same, so these are comparable. You see how much smaller the public sector is in the Philippines, and you see that in old age, taxes are about equal to benefits received. That's about what it looks like in California, too, for that matter. States which don't have big pension programs and Medicare and so on. You can see here that aging is going to be very expensive in the U.S. and not so expensive for the public sector. Maybe, in fact, it would be cost-saving in some sense in the Philippines. And then these are private transfers. I'm not going to be doing anything with the private transfers, but you can see how much more important the private transfers are in the Philippines. Again, the scales are the same. So you can compare these and they're much, much more important in the Philippines than in the U.S. And in the U.S., you can see that private transfers made, that is, these outflows, are greater than private transfers received all through adulthood, including in old age. Elderly people are on net making transfers, private transfers to their kids, whereas in the Philippines, after, I don't know exactly what this age is, maybe 70 or so, maybe a little bit older, you see that the elderly are receiving net private transfers in excess of what they're making. Okay, so that's by way of background, and yes, it really is that time. Okay, so I'll just speed through this to say, okay, we're going to be looking at support ratios. We imagine a coefficient beta that shifts the consumption age profile up or down depending on the resources available to pay for the consumption. And so here we have the population in some year times the age profile of consumption in a base year that is held fixed. And here we have the age distribution in some year times the labor income in that same base year that's held fixed. And as the in the base year, these two integrals should be equal under the simple in this simple economy rules, which I'm not going to go into since there's not much time now. But basically, we're summation of capital. And so when the age distribution becomes more favorable, beta can rise above 1. And when it's less favorable, beta drops below 1. And we're going to be looking for the level of fertility that gives a population growth rate that corresponds to a stable population age distribution that gives us the largest possible value of beta. That's what we're going to be doing. And okay, so let's look at a couple of at some examples over time in the non-stable case. So these are support ratios for Costa Rica based on Costa Rican parameters. And so this is the period. Costa Rica is still in a time frame, in a stage of the transition in which the population age distribution is becoming more favorable, the support ratio is rising, but in 20 years or so, that situation will change, population will age, and we'll be heading here towards perhaps, of course we don't know what's going to happen, but perhaps towards a stable population age distribution in the post-transition period. And so the interest here is, okay, what level of fertility will give the most beneficial support ratio in this stable stable circumstances, stable population circumstances. So here are some other countries. I think I'll just skip over those. This is perhaps of more interest. This is some developed countries. Here's the United States, for example, so a very non-classic transition because we have the baby boom, baby bust, and then the UN is projecting a lot of convergence. But if we look out to 2050, well, this is the decline in the support ratio that results from population aging as the baby boom retires. It's not huge. There's something like maybe a 10 or 12% decline in the support ratio as the population ages. And then, let's see, do I have, yeah, so this boils down to about 0.3% per year in terms of consumption due to the deteriorating support ratio. Germany, about 0.2% per year. Japan, 0.2%. Spain, a bigger drop here, closer to 1% per year as the population ages. And then here we'd be entering into the stable, something more like a stable population range. Okay, so is post-transition fertility too low? We've seen these big fluctuations in age distribution, and what we're going to be looking at is, as I said, the sort of after all that has happened, populations will continue to age due to continuing mortality decline, we expect. But if fertility stabilizes, then they reach what used to be called a quasi-stable population age distribution. It's close to a stable population age distribution. Okay. we can, let's just skip over this. Okay, so we can find numerically, or there's some analytic work we can do, which I'm not going to talk about, we can find what total fertility rate would maximize the support ratio for each of these countries. And that's what this column, the red column, does. And, well, you can see, first off, that the median fertility that maximizes the support ratio is very close to replacement. But there's some countries that are different. So our friends Nigeria and Austria, let's look at them. Nigeria, if you remember, old age is relatively inexpensive there because people work deep into old age and they don't consume that much. And children are very expensive because they don't work. And so what works for Nigeria is a very low level of fertility. If we look at Austria, what works for Austria is a very high level of fertility. Not extremely high, but high. So that's... So the outcome here depends on those actual age profiles and their regional differences and so on. There are other countries, something like Nigeria. These Southeast Asian countries, people work a long time. They have very meager public sector transfer programs. And so you see these low levels of fertility that are optimal. If we look at the European countries, well, Austria, I already mentioned, Germany, something like Austria, but generally these are right at replacement level. The US is at 2.2. Okay, now, another interesting thing to look at is, so we have the current total fertility rate down here. The intrinsic support ratio is the support ratio that would result from the stable population if this fertility remained constant. That's sort of the implication of the current level of fertility. And then here we have the support ratio that results from this maximizing fertility level. And then here is simple replacement level. And, well, look at Austria, for example. Its maximizing fertility level was 2.6. But there's virtually no difference between the support, there's hardly any difference between the support ratio you get from a TFR of 2.6 and the TFR you get from replacement level. So this is a very flat...
So you're coming out in favor of replacement fertility.
I haven't gotten there yet, Carl. No, no, that's not the bottom line. Could be. Look at Nigeria. Well, okay, there's a bigger difference between the support ratio with 1.3 and the replacement level. But in general, if you look at China, there's no discernible difference to two decimal places in the support ratio as you move across this fertility range. So if this is our criterion, in most cases, it just doesn't make that much difference once you get to steady state. It may make a lot of difference in the transitional stages, which, as we saw back there, can be, there's a lot of action there. Okay.
Ron, so these are for the current population age distribution, age profiles of consumption and income, or?
They're for the current age profiles of consumption and labor income.
So like 2010 or something like that?
No, well, I say current, what I mean is the base year for the NTA estimates, which I don't think they're as late as 2010 for any of the countries here, but they would mostly be between 1994 and 2009, I think, something like that. Ah. Most of them are in the 2000s.
So this makes no assumption.
What is the support ratio?
It is the ratio, if you calculate, suppose you go back to those labor income profile, consumption profile. You take some population age distribution and you multiply it times the labor income age profile and you get some mass of labor income as a result, a single number added up. And you do the same for consumption The support ratio is the ratio of that mass of labor income to the mass of consumption. So it's like a dependency ratio, except it's inverted. And instead of being, you know, zeros and ones, it's actual.
It's less than one because some of the money is coming from somewhere else.
Yeah, well, money comes from asset income. It comes from borrowing. If you're in the United States, you borrow internationally and all kinds of things like that. Yeah. Some of them are going to get repaid at some point. Yeah. Okay, so this is the overall support ratio. If we just looked at this, we might come out pretty much where Carl Mason said. And I should say, we're not the only ones who've done this, and we had a brown bag about 15 years ago from Jiang Lin, who did something like this, except not using these data, and Tolja was doing some things along this, and David Weil at Brown has done some stuff using our data. So it's not like no one has thought of this before, no one has that impression. Okay, now this is using the general support ratio, but I would say the changes in the support ratio with fertility are not particularly dramatic. I think people have an exaggerated notion of how much difference it makes, fertility makes, or the change in population age distribution makes in that context. But what does matter is if you look at where the consequences are more narrowly focused, which tends to be in the public sector, the pensions and the publicly provided health care and so on. So we can do something similar using the kind of thing I showed you for the United States and Philippines earlier, where instead of having labor income, you have tax payments by age, and instead of having consumption, you have government benefits received by age. So you can calculate what might be called a fiscal support ratio, and then you can ask, well, what total fertility rate would maximize the fiscal support ratio? Okay, so before we look at that, let's look at the age pattern of public transfers in different countries. This is a slide from Tim Miller, Chapter 7, one of the comparative chapters in this book. This is a comparative study of public transfers. And here we have public transfers to the elderly. This is relative to labor income age 30 to 49. And here are public transfers to children. And these are per capita. So this is per elderly person, and this is per child. And so if we were on a 45-degree line here, which I guess would go something like that, that would be equal transfers per child and per elderly person. But in fact, this slopes more in favor of public transfers to the elderly. And this is the, I think, the median, or maybe it's the mean intersection of these lines. I think these are the medians across there. Now, there are interesting regional patterns here. Latin America tends to have low expenditures on kids relative to the elderly. Brazil is the world champion by a very long shot. They have very generous public pensions and not that generous public education and so on. But Chile, Costa Rica are in that box as well. Uruguay and Mexico are sort of in that direction, but they're in this lower box that has a bunch of East Asian and South Asian countries. So we have China, Korea, Thailand, Philippines, India. Why is it Indonesia here? I'm not sure. I wonder if that's an unlabeled point for some country. Anyway, and then we have U.S. and Taiwan is actually more generous per child than per elderly in comparative context. But U.S., Taiwan, and Spain are up here. And then most of Western Europe is up here. Japan, with high transfers, both for kids and for the elderly. Japan is favoring, within this group, children. Austria is favoring the elderly. Sweden is perhaps slightly favoring the elderly. This is Germany. Okay, so that will give us some insight as we come to the next table, which is looking at what level of fertility maximizes the fiscal support ratio. And right off, you see, instead of being 2.0, now it's 2.6. And that's because the public sector, at least in the richer countries, is transferring a lot of resources to the elderly. But now, again, let's see. Now, unfortunately, Kenya and Nigeria are not on this, this table. And also, I'm not sure, this is a pasted-in picture rather than a live table, and I wasn't able to correct a bunch of these fertility rates that aren't correct. So some of these are wrong. But that doesn't affect this this column and this calculation. So what do we find here? Well, the champion I pointed out a moment ago, Brazil, with generous to elderly, per elder, relatively stingy to kids, has very high support rate, fiscal support ratio, maximizing fertility. And you get, you know, the difference between this support ratio and this one is something like a 40% difference in the level of consumption. So that's non-trivial. Even relative to the replacement level support ratio, this is not trivial. So, and generally in Latin America, with these generous transfer programs for the elderly, you see these high levels of fertility above the median, 2.6. And then here we have the European countries. Now, Austria, with that early retirement and early entry to the labor force, has a very high fiscal support ratio maximizing level. Germany, a little bit less so. Sweden, remember, it was tended to be in this towards favoring the elderly as well. It's fairly high. The U.S. is right around replacement level. What else can I point to here? Southeast Asia and South Asia is interesting here because you can see they're very low, and we can expect that Nigeria would look something like this as well, because they don't do much for the elderly and they do more for the children, and so the public sector does better with, so we saw the Philippines, the on net, they're doing nothing for the elderly through the public sector, but they are making, you know, their public education and so on for kids. So they're better off with low fertility, and that's true with most of these countries. India is right at about in place. Okay, so that's the next point. That's the first point of disagreement with Dr. Mason's proposal. And here's a regional summary, and incidentally, those were using own countries' mortality as well as fertility, and we might wonder, well, how much of that is due to differences in mortality between the countries? So this is, first of all, summarizing by region. So we see that South and Southeast Asia has this very low average maximizing fertility. Latin America has a very high one. Those are the two outliers. But here we see the same calculations, but all done assuming Japan's survival schedule, so much longer life, particularly for poor countries. And it doesn't change the basic picture. We still have South and Southeast Asia, low fertility in Latin America, high fertility, and the rest in between. Now, I want to move to including capital, which can be done in the same sort of analytic framework. Because if you choose higher fertility, then you have a higher growth rate of the population and higher growth rate of the labor force, And that means you have to save and invest more, and that reduces consumption and so on. And the more capital you have per worker, the bigger this effect of more rapid growth is. So there's a nice result from Arthur and McNichol back in 1978 in a comment on a very interesting paper by Samuelson, by Paul Samuelson, on optimal population growth rates, in which Samuelson made a famous error of not checking his second-order conditions, and he had found the welfare minimum rather than the welfare maximum in his paper, and there were comments, particularly Alan Deardorff was the one who first pointed this out. But this was another comment which was probably more, certainly I'd say, more interesting than the original Samuelson paper or than Deardorff's comment. And so this is looking at the effect of a little bump up in the population growth rate. And this part of it is just what we would have gotten when we were looking earlier at what maximizes the support ratio. This is the same sort of first order condition. The average age of consumption should equal the average age of labor income at the maximum. And that if the average age of consumption is greater, as it is in aging Western countries, then you want higher fertility and higher growth rate. If average age of consumption is lower than the average age of earning, then transfers are downward and you want lower fertility and so on. I didn't go into all that, I skipped over it. But in the fuller result that includes capital, then we have this. This is comparing golden rule steady state, so it's not perfectly general by any means. But the point here is that this is the capital consumption ratio, and so economies with more capital are going to have a bigger ratio here. And this is the effect that if you have a higher fertility and higher N, you've got to equip the workers with more capital, you've got to save more, and so on. So this works in the opposite direction to this in rich industrial countries, and you need to have the average age of consumption greater than the average age of labor income in order to offset this capital dilution effect. And so we expect that fertility, the maximizing level of fertility, is going to be lower in this case. So this is the result here. If we take sort of what is a typical capital labor ratio in rich industrial countries and hold it constant while we vary fertility and take into account the cost of holding it constant by saving more and investing more and so on, then we find now a median maximizing level of fertility that takes into account both the support ratio and the costs of more rapid growth in terms of, or the advantages of population decline in terms of needing lower savings rates. So now we get a median of 1.5. So this is taking, this is the capital labor ratio was given and just optimizing or maximizing on fertility. And here we try looking for the so-called goldenest golden rule, which was a term that came out of Samuelson's original this article I just mentioned, and in which you try to maximize, there's Bernardo right there. You try to maximize both fertility and the capital intensity and the capital labor ratio. So you're maximizing in two dimensions, and you choose, if fertility is lower, then you would choose a higher capital labor ratio. If the capital labor ratio is higher, you would choose lower fertility. And so there needn't be a solution that maximizes, an interior solution that maximizes both of these at the same time. But for these countries, there is. And if you look at the median there, it's even lower than in this case. So what do we conclude from this? Well, I mentioned the limitations. I won't go over them again, but there's a suggestion here that rich industrial nations maybe are overly concerned with their low fertility. If you look at it in a broader context, if you just focus on what helps the fiscal health of the public sector, then you're pushed in the direction of wanting fertility to be higher and so on. If you take a broader look at the whole network of these intergenerational relations, both public sector, but more important, perhaps the private sector as well, and you take into account the saving and dissaving and so on, then fertility below replacement begins to look more appealing. Now, what about the fact that these age profiles are going to change, that the labor income we expect is going to, that right tail is going to drift upwards, people are going to work longer and retire later and so on? Well, you might say that's going to push us in the direction of Nigeria, which favors lower fertility rather than higher fertility. But the other side of this is the rising healthcare costs. And if those continue to go up, as who knows what's going to happen in the U.S., for example, supposedly the Health Care Reform Act has put mechanisms in place to make healthcare costs per enrollee not rise faster than per capita income or something like that. That would pretty much take care of this if that really happened. But if those healthcare costs keep drifting up faster than per capita income growth or productivity growth, then the consumption side of the age profile begins to look worse and worse, and then there would be, that would suggest moving towards higher fertility. Okay, let me just end. So this is just a quick overview of those different levels, but let me just end by saying, if we go back to that UN survey on which countries think their fertility is too high and which are think they're too low. Okay, there are 22 cases in the UN data. In 18 out of those, this optimal fertility calculation or maximizing support ratio or whatever, in the simple one, the first one I did, predicts national policy in 18 out of the 22 cases in this sense, that if actual fertility is more than 0.2 above optimal, then they have policies in place to reduce fertility. I'm not talking here about attitudes, but actual pronatalist policies. If fertility is within 0.2 of optimal, then 7 of the 8 countries have no policies to change fertility, and 6 of the 9 countries with actual fertility less than 0.2 below optimal do have policies. And then I finally have to say, I think it gets 2 more countries right than just using replacement levels instead of down. Okay. That's it.
So Mark, you used each of those countries as being a closed economy?
Yes, these are closed economies.
So if capital flows between countries, does it really change things much?
Well, let's see. Since this is looking at steady states, I guess it would depend on whether you think that you could permanently run a negative in the international capital flow account or something like that.
Well, it occurred to me that then capital would be dependent on the world population ratios.
Yeah.
And then given that it doesn't seem to matter much, it doesn't seem like it would change things much at all.
Yeah.
To have.
No, I think that you're right. It's that the right way to look at this is in terms of global capital markets, and then if we think of the countries as relatively small countries that have to take, then countries are taking their return to capital and their wage rates is given for the international economy and so on, and then we look at say the rich countries as a whole and compare them to poor countries as a whole, and we can study resource flows and so on. And so there have been detailed macro simulations done along those lines, for example, by Axel Borst-Supens team in Mannheim, now it is in the Max Planck Institute, and I think he chops the world up into two or three regions like that and looks at these flows. And how much difference would that make here? I guess it wouldn't affect the first story, just the support ratio story, but it would affect this last one in which you're taking capital labor ratios into account. I mean, yes, what happens in the U.S. isn't going to have a big effect on those capital labor ratios. They will be set by international investors. On the other hand, what happens in the U.S. will determine how much asset income there is in addition to the labor income. There's a lot or little. It will depend on whether we're on net exporting capital or importing capital. Yeah. So, Ruth.
This is fascinating on the fertility side, but what it doesn't seem to address at all is the essential problem, even in the wealthy countries, which is most cannot make productive use of their working age population now. So the idea that raising the birth rate is going to somehow improve the income flows seems a little sort of upside down thinking when you have high levels of unemployment, high levels of underemployment, people who are out of the labor force, even though they like to be in it, people who are basically unemployable. You see that in the United States. So when we talk about keeping people longer in the labor force, of course, then that flies in the face of the need to open up opportunities for younger people to go into the labor force. So I'm just wondering how that all fits into this thinking. You're sort of taking these income and consumption as sort of given and showing the implications of fertility for that. But those are all different stories, right? And they're all amenable to different kind of policy issues.
The second part of your point was about increasing labor supply at older ages and whether that would make worse the problem of young people looking for jobs and so on. So there's been that's a common view in Europe.
Yeah.
U.S. economists are very dismissive of that view, and there's a recent study by Ruber and Wise, who had a series of international comparative studies that addresses exactly this issue, and they conclude no, if anything, having more older people working perhaps has a slight positive for employment for the young. And they look at that's based on partly looking at their work on the structure of retirement systems, because a lot of the European systems have incentives to get older people out of the labor force because they thought that would make room for younger people. So they can use those as an instrument. No, it didn't. Yeah. It doesn't work. Uh-huh. And they look at some specific programs, like in Denmark, there was a one-time adjustment that was supposed to make room, and it had the opposite effect. I'm not sure about the French moving to the 35-hour. I don't remember. But I think the basic idea is that someone who works is consuming out of the income, and they're generating demand, more demand for output by virtue of working and creating that income. And if we look at the second half of the 20th century, we see this enormous increase in female labor supply, for example, in the U.S., which didn't displace male workers. And so those are the kinds of arguments. The first part is harder to answer, I think. We have to imagine we're not in a crisis situation. If we're in a crisis situation, then this is steady. This is long term.
Okay.
So let's hope we're not going to be in a crisis situation, and there will be jobs for young people. Let's see. That's the what was it? Want and hope, wish and hope. What was it we had last week? Richard.
I'm a little uncertain about how you treat private transfers when people die. We don't know very much about who gets the
bequests are not in here.
Oh, that's good. could be a big...
Yeah, it's a big factor, and we just don't yet have requests, except for a couple of countries.
I was about to suggest that an implication of your work is that you could help the fiscal side of things by taxing inheritances at very high rates. Because then that money goes back into the fisc and helps the and helps the government budget.
Yeah. So incorporating information on bequest flows is one of the next things on our agenda, and I think it is very important. I think it's a big missing actor in this story, because I think a lot of what the public pension systems have done is to enable elderly people to save their assets and consume out of their public pensions, and that they're going to be the big bequests when they die. Yeah. Carl?
You mentioned that this analysis predicts the pronatalist policies. Don't the pronatalist policies also raise public costs of young people, and thus, in this analysis, counterproductive?
I guess you could ask how much might you want to pay couples to have another kid.
Yeah. But in doing that,
you raise that cost, so you then you pay somewhat less. I don't know. You're right. You have to do some further calculation.
So while this may predict the policies, it also predicts that they're not reading this paper.
you have to imagine that the policy consists of saying in the newspaper, please have 2.5 kids. Please do something. Yeah.
And the United States replacement or this desirable rate was 2.12, as I recall.
That was under one, yeah, it's right around there, and they're all scenarios.
What happens if the Obama health care program actually goes through? Is that going to raise that rate, that number?
Well, if the health care plan, I'm not sure whether you mean the contraception side of what Obama's been talking about.
Everybody having
to have
health care.
Yeah, well, a part of the Obama health care reforms is cost containment for Medicare. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, then this leaves this analysis intact. Okay. If it doesn't contain costs, and I don't think most people expect that it will, then the situation changes in a direction which is going to be more favorable towards higher fertility.
Okay.
Kim?
So, this analysis, as you explained at the beginning, is invariant to size.
Yeah.
It's entirely on the basis of ratios, and so if one doubles the population of India or quadruples it, in this analysis one still has the same outcomes. But there is some work, I guess, in Ilio, when the airplanes are playing around, in which one looks at the characteristics of consumption profiles in terms of resource requirements. And so you're trying to see sort of the sustainable economy calculations that people do, what age structures, the implications of age structures for resource depletion, things of this sort. So I was wondering, as we saw the Arthur McNichol piece on K over C ratios, is there analytic work going forward which would allow a size term to be factored into any of these calculations?
Well, Emilio's also depends on ratios, I guess, since it's basically that age distribution of household heads or something like that. Work on size would be work being done by environmentalists and people like, is it Mike O'Brien, is that his name? There's a whole network on the web, PERN, very active group. I would say, yes, they're looking at scale effects.
Something of that kind be folded back
into this
kind of calculation. because in the stable state, your crops go out to 2090 or something. Yeah. And so these different fertility rates in places like Nigeria or some of the other places have very big differences in size factors.
Yeah.
Just as a technical question, it seems to be interesting to think how one would go about incorporating somehow some kind of cost to resource scarcity.
I'm not really sure how to do that. Now, I have tried taking natural resources as part of what gets transferred, in the sense that there's some national stock of resources, which you might think of loosely as being owned by the population. And in early work I did with Barney Cohen and Tim Miller, we tried to take that into account. And for some Saudi Arabia, or maybe for Alaska, it would make quite a bit of difference. For the U.S. and I don't remember the details of that, but I think that's not really what you're getting at. You're getting at something that has more to do with the population impact on the global environment, and I'm not sure how to do that, but I certainly agree it's a very important factor. Of course, if people took these kinds of calculations seriously, then population's going to grow less rapidly and fertility would be lower, and unless it's governments trying to maximize their public sector finances, which might be the way at all. Probably we should.